Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Lisa Anderson with us is the research director for ApprovenProduct.com, a site dedicated to empowering consumers to make informed supplement decisions. She spent the last 2 years digging through scientific research on this and other nutritional supplements. A lively guest with an infectious excitement. I'm waiting for it. And let's say, hi, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you tonight?
Oh, you're infectious. It was good. They told the truth.
Thank you.
That's great. By the way, we talk about supplements. I take billions of supplements all day long. How do you know which is the right things to take? And when I say that, there is so much information coming through about take this, you'll do that. And then 10 months later, if you've taken that, there's a lawsuit. It's very confusing today.
It is. And that's one of the reasons why a proven product was formed. Our CEO, Joe, was interested in the exact same question, and he went online to do research on his own, and it's kind of like wandering in the wilderness. It's very confusing. There's a lot of different voices calling out to you saying, buy this now, and so it was very difficult to find objective information, and so that's why he formed this company, and he pulled together a little group of us that do a lot of research all day, and we try to answer that. And one answer to the question is it kind of depends. It depends on you. It depends on what your goals are as far as your health is. It depends on where you're at now. I mean, if you need to lose weight, there may be some things you might want to take. If you need to lower your blood pressure, there may be something different that you might want to take. So it kind of depends a lot on you.
Okay, so, you know, cutting through all the diet things and so on and so forth, you guys have come up with something that seems to go beyond what anything else has done so far. And if enough people find out about it, it could be the answer to a problem out there.
Well, I think so. It's not necessarily something we've done. It's a supplement that we've found, and there's some pretty good research behind it. And the catchy little thing I would say is, wouldn't it be great if there were a pill that made eating French fries okay? And it's not always easy to eat healthy. We're all really busy. We're all always on the run. And most of the time that means more trips through the drive-thru than we would like to admit. It will be great if we could all come home and cook that nice, healthy home-cooked meal every night, but most of us live in the real world and we can't do that. So for those times, it would be really nice to know that there's a supplement that you're taking that kind of mitigates, you know, some of those trips into deep-fried territory.
Okay, now, by the way, does it just take away the urge for it, or if you get into that territory, does it take care of what that territory can do to you?
It helps take care of what the territory can do to you. It doesn't. I don't know that there's a whole lot that you can ever do to make deep fried chicken not taste good or not look appetizing.
Yeah.
But there are a couple different supplements. The one I wanted to talk about tonight is something called astaxanthin. And what happened was when researchers were studying this, they would feed it, you know, first off, they always test it on mice. And what they would do is feed a high-fat diet to the mice, and half the mice they'll put on astaxanthin, and the other half they'll put on, you know, just the high-fat diet. And the ones eating the high-fat diet, of course, they get really fat, and they get diabetes, and they get heart problems, and they get all kind of problems. The ones when they fed astaxanthin to them in addition to the high-fat diet did not gain the weight that the other mice did. And they also didn't have the heart problems, and they didn't have the other problems. There is something in this supplement that mitigates that high fat in the diet.
Now, did you probe through? What is it that does that?
They really haven't narrowed that down. Now, one thing that they have discovered is that it seems to accelerate, it accelerates the normal decrease of body fat that happens when you exercise. It helps to move fats into the mitochondria and help you use fat for energy rather than, you know, the available energy or sugar or carbs for your energy. It enhances something called CPT1 activity, and what that does is it's the protein that moves the fat through your cell membrane. So what it does is it spares sugars and helps you use fat stores instead of those for your energy.
Okay, now, by the way, this particular element, you know, within the supplement, is that something that you guys have specifically? Can you get that everywhere? Or is that something that we have to come to you for?
No, you do not have to come to us for it. You can get it all over the place. It's not something that you've maybe heard a lot of, but it's out there in a lot of different places. There are better ways to get it than others, but it's certainly available in a lot of different places.
Okay, now, by the way, the nutrient in and of itself, okay, you guys didn't create it, but what are you doing? What's your purpose behind it?
Our purpose behind it is just always, we have several different categories on our website where we go out and research the absolute best available answer to a problem. And one of the problems that our customers had presented to us was fish oil. They wanted us to find the best possible fish oil. And when we looked into that, we found out that fish oil isn't the best answer. It's actually something called krill oil. And that led us to astaxanthin, because astaxanthin exists in krill oil, and it's one of the components that make krill oil so much better than just taking fish oil. So that's gotten me a little bit ahead of myself. But that's how we came to it, was through that route.
Okay, so in essence, one of the things it'll do, it'll basically eliminate the fat storage. It'll cause the fat to move through. I heard you say that. What other benefits? Are there heart benefits with it? What other benefits are there?
There are. There are cardiovascular benefits. One of the reasons that we may have problems with cardiovascular disease is it may have its roots in oxidative stress and inflammation. Oxidative stress is kind of like rust to metal. It's where free radicals take electrons from cells in your body for themselves, and then it starts a chain reaction, and then, like I said, it's kind of like rust to metal, only it's inside your body. Astaxanthin is one of the most powerful antioxidants that have been discovered, and so it stops that process, and it helps to end that oxidative stress in your body. It's an anti-inflammatory, and so they've found a lot of great promise with it having an effect against cardiovascular disease. It can lower high blood pressure. It can improve cardiovascular remodeling. Supplementing with it has been shown to reduce systolic blood pressure and triglycerides in people with metabolic syndrome. It's shown a lot of promise in a lot of different ways in a lot of different studies.
Okay, now let me ask you this. If I go to your website, which, by the way, the website is what?
aprovenproduct.com.
Okay, now if I go to the website, what am I going to find?
You'll find on the homepage, you'll find a little mission statement about us. Over on the right-hand side, you'll see a list of the different topics that we cover. If you look up at the top, if you want to just find our research, up at the top there's a link that says News and Research, and that takes you to our blog, and that can show you, that's where you can find a lot of these different links to the different studies and stuff. But I've also set up a special site for your listeners tonight. If they'll go to aprovenproduct.com and do /busy, there's a page where I've got some free downloads where you can download a list of better foods to get at the drive-through, as well as some other things there.
Wonderful. Okay, we're just about out of time. So one more time, please, slowly with the website.
Okay. It's www.aprovenproduct.com/busy. And like I said, you can get a list of better items to get at the drive-through, so that when you hit it, it's not so bad on your hips. And it'll also tell you the best way to get an astaxanthin is within krill oil. You absorb it a lot better if you take it within a krill oil supplement. And there's a download there also about how to choose a better krill oil supplement, how to pick one that will work for you. And also there's a lot of information about what astaxanthin can do for you.
Wonderful. Hey, Lisa, thank you so much for your time tonight.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks. You too. Good night.
There's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be.
like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Andy McCabe with us. He's the author of The Gifted One, The Journey Begins, a self-help book done in novel form. He's presented stress management programs for educational, medical, law enforcement, and corporate groups, as well as for the officers and crews of the United States Navy and aircraft carrier Lexington. He received his PhD in 1999 from Rutgers University, School of Applied and Professional Psychology. And let us say, Andy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, and by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, the title in and of itself really says the same thing, you know, the gifted one. You know, we are all, if we look very deep, we are all gifted, and the journey really begins the minute you open your eyes and you see that first step in front of your shoe, and I guess that's the one that's going to get you there.
Well, I like that, and I agree that we're all gifted, and what I'm hoping what this book will do is awaken some folks, or a lot of folks, to actually see the gifts within themselves that they don't see right now.
Now, by the way, what was it that triggered you to put this to pen? What was that moment that you looked at the world through just a little bit different eyes and said, I've got to do this. I've got to get this message out.
About 20 years ago or so, I had the good fortune of meeting a guy who was a mystic. And he was a Trappist monk who I got to spend about 3 hours with. His name was Theophane. And what was so cool about it is that I had never met anybody like that. I never met a mystic. And we hit it off really well, and he seemed to like what I was thinking, and I definitely liked what he was thinking. And as a result, after spending the time with him, he basically changed my life forever, just by what he thought and how he acted and how he lived. And I got the idea then, and then went to Rutgers to get my doctorate in psychology and finished that up, and then after that, I finished the book. I spent 6 years traveling around the country and meeting all kinds of holy people and shamans and medicine men and you name it. So that's how it happened.
By the way, do you find, you know, with the shamans, the medicine men, and all of the people that you've talked to, was there an overarching theme? Was there that certain spark, that certain something that they all had in common, even though the languages were different, but there was something underneath that held it all together?
Absolutely. And the thing that was consistent was that the best of the folks I met, they're all humble. And I also met some quacks. I mean, not everybody is what I would think is legitimate. And again, this is just my opinion as to what legitimate is. But
sure.
I met some folks that I don't think were what they pretended to be, but some folks really were. And those folks are always humble, and they were extremely compassionate and kind. And if I was going to take one word, that they were kind. That was the overarching quality that they all had.
That theme, you know, interesting. I'm looking at your press release, and it, you know, it's so true. You know, we live in such a world that desperately needs some kind of a change. You know, this one hates that one hates this one, and it's you know, this one's fault, and so on and so forth. And I've watched what's gone on in our country in the last 3-4 years, that the separation, the division of you know, the ethnicity, the gender, the whatever, nobody seems to be on the same page anymore. And everybody is searching for that something called identity. And whether it's spiritual, whatever the case may be, we end up flocking to that. And most people are so busy that they just don't take the time to realize that the answers that they want are going to come internally, not externally.
Yeah, the another reason for writing the book was that I'm a psychologist, and I've done a lot of, my press release states, I've done a lot of work in stress management. And what I found is that an awful lot of people really don't understand what's going on around them. And I'm not pretending to be any kind of genius, but because of my training and the courses I've taken and the people I've met, I thought, wouldn't it be neat to help people to awaken a little bit so that when something's in front of them that they're not seeing, that I can show them it. And what's been fun is I did that in the form of a novel because I've been into the self-help field for a long time, and when you learn the 5 ways to do this or the 10 ways to do that, after you read them, it's boring. So I decided, let me put this together in a novel form with characters that people can identify with and care about. I even put in a little love story in the self-help book, and it keeps people turning the pages who've never read a book. So that's kind of fun.
Well, what I think is one of the great things about the way that you've done it, if you go all the way back to the original Star Trek, and I think the greatest example for me was there was a fellow by, I don't know if he's even alive anymore, but there was a character actor by the name of Frank Gorshin, and he was starring on one of the series. It was the original one with Kirk and Spock and the rest of them. And he came on the starship, and he's excited, and he's frightened to death, and the left side of his body is black, the right side of his body is white. And what's he running from? Well, they're going to get him from his planet. They want to kill him because he's different, because they're black and white on the reverse side. And what they did was they took a situation, a condition, a problem that we face culturally today, framed it in such a way that it wasn't you making the decision what's good or bad or who's black or white or who's the best and whatever, but you got to see it away from you, and you get to recognize your own problems or the cultural problems, and you got to make the decision of how stupid it was. And at the same time, if you had to be asked individually face-to-face, you got to be careful of how you create your answer because of what somebody's going to see, feel, or experience. So I think in a novel setting is wonderful because you can look outside of yourself, see it through a third-party experience, and then make your decision from there.
You sound like you read the book because that's exactly what I tried to do and make it non-threatening so that the things that are happening to someone else, but you're getting the benefit of it.
Yeah, yeah. And we live, you know, vicariously through other people.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, it's been fun. It's been a great ride, Michael. This is the first of 3, by the way. And there'll be another one that I'm halfway through almost. And that will be the gifted one on the road. And the final one will be the gifted one coming home. So I'm having a great time.
No, and by the way, I think with the books, and if you get something like what you're talking about, as you're speaking, I'm visualizing, I'm getting a grasp of what it is that you're doing. But when you get a book like that, and people recognize themselves, and you just said it a moment ago, helping people see what they don't see. It's good sometimes to have somebody look over your shoulder, and they'll see what it is that's right in front of you that you don't see. And a book like that, when it's about people, it's about you, it's about me, it's about everybody and the problems that we end up facing. The book is not a book, it's alive. And I would venture to guess that if somebody picked it up and read it and then reread it, they'd get something different and then reread it again. And each time there's another dimension of what it is that you're of the subject matter, that it's got to keep going and growing as you get into it and read it. Because if I read it, and it brings me to a certain level, now I have a different understanding, And based on that understanding, I reread it again, and then I expand.
Yeah, the nicely said. And in addition to that, one of the things that happens with us guys, maybe not someone like yourself because of your business, but you know, you've all heard that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and we don't understand each other. And well, this is what I tried to do in the book also, is kind of make both men and women understand each other a little bit better.
Yeah.
And let them see how the other people are thinking, because the language is very different, and we're never taught any of this stuff in school. And as a matter of fact, that's probably another overarching thing with the book. I tried to take 12 really relevant concepts to the times, to right now, and talk about them and give people insights that we don't get in school. And as a matter of fact, most people don't know a lot of what's in the book. Many professionals don't know what's in the book. Some do, some of course do. But the end result of meeting with all these people and taking all these courses is that it allowed me to put something together that, from what they're telling me, hasn't been done before. A self-help book in the form of a novel. And that's kind of cool. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Now, by the way, I understood women all my life until we hit a certain cultural level, and then I got told that I didn't. And if I took certain courses, I would finally be able to understand. And I think there's where some confusion is, too. There's the men are from Mars, the women are from whatever it is. It gets to a point whereby, you know, we get told, and the people that are writing the book, for the most part, have no idea what it is they're dealing with. They've been kicked in the rear end most of their life, and now they're going to come back and give you, you know, their perspective on something. And I think that's what you were talking about, those that don't know, and then some that do know. And it gets very confusing about who was who. I believe in my heart of hearts that I have a sister who's a few years younger than I am. If we would have been brought up a genderless, me as a man, she as a woman, but just genderless, and my mom treated us the same, we had the exact same friends, we went to the same places, behavior, I believe that we would have turned out very much alike.
Yeah. There's that's a kind of an interesting concept. What role does parenting play, and for boys and girls and expectations and all that kind of thing? And
sure.
Part of my intent also, and again, sounds like I have lots of intents, but I do, is that I'm hoping that for Christmas or the birthday or for whatever, that women will buy this book not just for their friends, but especially for their boyfriend, their husband, their father. And I wrote it kind of, I tried to do it in a manly way. Not that it's, you know, there's an unmanly way to write, but I tried to do it in a way that even a construction worker who may not be a reader could say, that wasn't bad. I got something out of that. So what's not flowery, it's very blue collar.
And by the way, I hear you loud and clear.
Everybody.
And I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, Andy, bar none, the biggest problems is we're told what to think, how to say things, because if you don't, there's consequences and this is going to happen and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
I still think John Wayne should be the president, and I will never change my mind.
Yeah.
Radio Susie just rolled her eyes at me.
Michael, there's a wonderful point on that I'd like to make, and, you know, if my father, who passed away many years ago, if he read the book, I think he'd like it. He was a pipe fitter, and John Wayne was his main guy.
My kind of guy.
The point I want to make is this, is that right now what's happening in our world and in our cities and our states and in the United States and the world is folks have stopped taking responsibility. Not everyone, certainly not everyone. But enough folks have stopped taking responsibility, and they don't say, well, it's my fault that this happened. And I'll give you just a quick for instance. Most of my life, I've worked with kids that have severe behavior disorders. And almost always, it involves, certainly there are genetics involved, but especially the gang kids, almost always it's a lack of a family, lack of a dad who cares about them or who even admits that it's his child, And when you don't take responsibility, what happens is that people feel unloved, and they don't feel worthy, and then they look for a family in gangs, which is what happens. Then you take that to the cities where we had politicians who stole and did horrible things. You take it to the state, the same thing happened where, you know, I know in New Jersey, our Social Security and pensions, and what happened to everything? Where did it all go? And of course, what happened is politicians did things that we didn't know about, and they didn't take responsibility by telling folks. Now it's happening in our federal government, where, as I mentioned, the Democrats hate the Republicans, and nobody wants to talk, and it's not good.
No, not at all. And let me give you my first time I've done this on the air, my real definition of John Wayne. All right. Not the be-all, end-all man, but in the world of John Wayne, I was probably raised at the time your dad was raised. And in those days, you went to the movies, and the good guy shot the gun out of the bad guy's hands. If there was a bedroom scene that was 1 foot on the floor, that was the law, Doris Day, and so on and so forth. See, in those days, right, people, for the most part, were responsible. They didn't have what we have today, and the availability of drugs, and when I say guns, I own guns, but the putting them in the hands of kids that are going to go out and shoot somebody. Look at all the lockdowns that they're having today. It was a different era, and it was a different time. You hit the nail on the head when you said it. If I'm not accepted at home, accepted is the big word here. I want to be accepted. I want identity. And if you're not going to give me identity at home, I'm going to go out and find it someplace else. And that's what's happening. Look at the percentages of dropouts in the schools today. It's not money to drop into an educational system. It's giving those kids the value for being in school is senior to the value for being out in the street and being in a gang or whatever the case may be. We are in a valueless society, and or the values are pointed in directions that aren't constructive. And if we're not careful, we're going to fall down.
Well, I think we already have, Michael, and if I can just add on to what you had just said, that, you know, I think it's really important for folks to feel accepted, you know, regardless of how bright they are or what race or color or sexual orientation, and they need to, but at the same time, they need to feel competent. And as an educator, I've been a college professor now for 11 years. One of the things that I talk to my students about all the time is that if boys especially would rather be bad than stupid, and so they'll act, if they don't feel competent, they'll act out and they'll cause difficulty, cause problems. And almost every kid I've ever worked with, and I've worked with thousands, every one of them underneath wants to be competent. Yeah. And what I mean by that is, and if they can't be competent in school, they'll be the best car thief or the best whatever. And they'll tell you, I'm the best car thief in Union City or someplace. And it's, again, this need to be competent. We need to feel competent, because with competency means we're worthy, and that means we're worthy of love. And we all want to be worthy of love. And so the book addresses this kind of stuff as well, and having to do with responsibility. And schools don't look at that. You know, you can be great in all the subjects, but lousy in math, and, you know, gee, it's too bad you're so stupid in math. And, well, you may be a brilliant orator or a brilliant scientist, but just not a math person. So I know you get what I'm talking about, but,
sure,
you know, the message is that, as we started out, by the way, everybody has a gift, and I wish that in education we tried more to find the gifts rather than the areas that need assistance.
Absolutely. Andy, we're just about out of time, but I want to end it with this, that we talk about acceptance, we talk about identity. Adolf Hitler, right before the Second World War and leading into the Second World War, did that with the, I'm not going to say the German population, but the Nazi population. What he did, he took a country that was going through some economic, really hard times. They weren't quite sure who they were. They were very confused, if that doesn't sound familiar. And what he did was he slapped uniforms on and gave them armbands, and now they had identity, and they killed for that identity. That's where the problem is. prime example.
Yeah. Michael, as you know in my bio there, I do a lot of public speaking and that kind of thing. And is there a way if folks would like to contact me that we could do that?
Oh, and please, your website.
The website, or they can email me at dramccabe@hotmail.com. D as in David, R as in Robert, A as in Apple, mccabe@hotmail.com. And this was great fun. Anything else, Michael?
No, we're good to go. We're just about out of time. And if anybody missed it, Andy, it'll be up on our website for them to catch.
Very cool.
And,
you're a great interviewer.
Thank you. And thank you so much for being here tonight. Take care.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Good night.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'm gonna go my way by myself. Love is only a dance. I'll try to apply myself. Teach my heart how to sing. Yeah, you can bet I'll go my way by myself. Like a bird on the wing, I'll face the unknown. I'll build a world all my own. Then nobody knows better than I myself. I'm by myself alone. When you're alone, who cares for starlit skies? When you're alone, magic moonlight dies. At break of dawn, there is no sunrise when your lover has gone. What lonely hours, all evening.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Nina Mirror's back. We're talking writing books, how to write a book, blogging, and you name it, why authors need to blog. And she is here. And Nina, hi.
Ray?
Hi. That was the intro. Hi.
Hi.
Oh, and by the way, no, let me do it this way. Watch this. Watch this. Susie, watch this. This is good. Watch this. Wait, listen to the music. Would you like to dance? I love that music coming in. How are you, Nina?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Are you in New York?
I'm not in New York. That's next week.
Ah, what's in New York?
What's in New York? My son and my daughter. And my son has a performance, so we're going to New York to see it.
Oh, what is he? He dances.
He's a dancer.
Oh, when is he going to... Susie's over here yelling at me. He's that dancer. Yes, she's excited. Oh,
I have that other blog about dance.
When is he going to be on Dancing with the Stars?
He doesn't do that kind of dance.
Oh, what kind of dance?
He's doing ballet. He's at the School of American Ballet
really?
Now.
Oh, man.
He's hoping to one day be a professional ballet dancer.
I'll bet he's in condition.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to mess with him.
No,
he's doing weightlifting a couple times a week, and he lifts girls. He's quite buff, as he likes to say.
Yeah, but when you really come down to it, when you talk ballet, look at the physical condition and also the mental discipline you have to go through to do that.
Yeah, it's actually pretty amazing. People don't realize how difficult it is and how strong ballet dancers are. There's this guy that we know.
He's a ballet dancer for the San Francisco Ballet, and he was on the subway in San Francisco, and some guy tried to steal his iPhone. Boy, was he sorry.
Yeah.
And he's a little guy. I mean, he's not a big man. He's a fairly short ballet dancer, and he knocked this guy out when he tried to take his iPhone.
No, absolutely. If you can imagine just the 3 or 4 or 5 minutes that maybe somebody is doing some kind of a centered dancing, what they go through and the jumps and the moves and the lifting that they do, you bet they got to be in condition.
It's enormously difficult. These guys are so strong, really strong. I mean, just it's amazing. I interview a lot of dancers, and you know, they if you look at a really great male dancer on stage, one of these guys who gets up there wearing next to nothing, they look like bodybuilders.
Yeah, that's true.
They're beautiful.
Yeah. I once watched Radio Susie get dropped on her head. You can hear, I'm serious, you could hear the thud through the entire room. But somebody lifted her. They were dancing, and they did one of these really big lifts. And when he dropped her, he went down too far, and you can just thud.
I shouldn't be laughing. Does Radio Susie like to do ballroom dancing? Is that what she does?
Big time ballroom dancer. Oh, she had lots of experience in that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, she's impressed. Yeah, and her head is still sore. But yeah, I saw that, and I said, "This is not for me. I'll watch. I'll sit back here and do the good stuff." Okay, let's go to Author's Platform, which I think is really good. One big question, what's the one thing that every nonfiction author and arguably every fiction author needs if they want to get published? What is it?
It's an author's platform.
Aha.
That is exactly what they need. They need an author's platform.
Okay, comes the next question. You know it's coming. What is it?
What is an author's platform? Well, I like to describe it as a built-in readership, but it really, you know, you have to talk about what makes up an author's platform. But an author's platform is who knows you and who's going to run out and buy your book once it comes out. So it's your fan base, really. And, you know, that's how I describe it. It's your fan base. You know, who's going to buy your book? Who knows who you are?
But that's a very important question. Who knows who you are? And that is a major step for most people that are in front of any kind of an audience. If they don't know who you are, you're in big trouble. It's like somebody who has this great book and nobody buys it. It's like having a party, this wonderful party, and you open the door, you're ready for a big party, you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to entertain everybody, and nobody's there. Well, maybe because you forgot to invite anybody.
Well, that's right. And the funny thing is that I go out and I speak before audiences, and it's as if, you know, they just have no idea about this. And I have to admit that 10 years ago, when I sent out my first book proposal, it went out to, you know, I sent it out to all these big-time agents. I wanted a big-time publisher, so I went for the big-time agents. And the first agent who called me up, of all things, you know, I was very lucky, and I sent out my first proposal, and I got an agent who called me up, and she was very interested, and she said, "I love your book, you know, the book subject, I like the title, you're a great writer, you wrote a great proposal." And then came those three letters, you know, but, B-U-T, she said, "I can't represent you." Well, I couldn't understand that. Why? Why can't you represent me? She said, "You have no platform." Well, this was the first I'd heard of it, but that was 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, platform was just becoming the buzzword in the publishing industry. Now, 10 years later or 12 years later, platform is well known. It's well established that this is what you need. You have to have an author's platform. So I'm always so surprised when aspiring authors and writers don't know that they have to have this, that people have to know who they are, or no one will know to buy their book. Like you said, nobody will have been invited to the party.
Yeah, okay. Now, but what's the first step? Well, obviously, we know why we need it. If nobody's out there and they don't know you're there, I don't care what you've done, it doesn't do much good. But there's got to be a first step to get you to begin to build that platform.
Right. So there are lots of nails you can put in that platform, or boards you can put in your platform, and they can do what I'm doing. They can get on the radio. So that's one thing they can do. A lot of people feel, though, that it's the chicken before the egg, and that's the first thing they have to get rid of, is this mentality that they have to have their book before they can do anything to build their platform. But they have to see themselves as an expert. They have to begin to achieve that expert status by getting out and doing things, like getting on the radio, getting on TV if they can, getting on... quoted in the newspaper, or writing articles for publications. They can begin getting on some of the internet shows, and they can have a blog. Writers can write, so there's some great things they can do as writers, and one of them is to have a blog. Blogs are a phenomenal way to build your expert status and to get known out in the internet. They can also write blog posts for other people's blogs, be an expert guest blogger. They can do social networking. Social networking is a huge way and a great way today to build platform. You can go, be on Facebook, be on Twitter, be on LinkedIn if you're a professional. You can be on Google Plus now. And on LinkedIn, if you're a professional, go into all the groups and forums and really participate there. There's a great way to drive traffic to your website and to gain, friends, followers, tweeple, connections, all those things. Also, YouTube is huge now. You can put videos up that talk about, where you're talking about your book or your book-to-be if your book isn't out yet. You can this way, you can establish that you're an expert. You can give information on what you're doing and drive people to your website, to your blog. All that stuff, go out and speak. Go out and speak before audiences. That's huge. That's always been sort of the staple of a great platform, is to be a speaker. Although I really think these days you can reach way more people on the internet with a blog, or with an internet radio show, or with radio. Radio reaches way more people. A show like this reaches way more people. And a mailing list. Mailing list has always been, it's never going to go away. So even when social networking fails or people migrate from Facebook to Google Plus, your mailing list is always going to be there. And that's both a physical mailing list, a snail mail, and an email list. So that's a really great thing to try to build up. And so all of those elements together, if you can do all of them, that's great. And that's going to build a really strong author's platform. But you don't have to have all of them. You can have a few of them, or you could have one. You could be a blogger who has, 100,000 people or, 10,000 people a day showing up at your blog, and that's going to be perceived by a publisher as a big platform.
Now, by the way, the other thing, you were mentioning radio, and there is another facet of radio that most people don't think about. You can become a radio host. And, there are places where you can go on maybe an hour a week just to get the feel of it and move from there. So, people who are starting these kind of things, they can end up with their own show, and even if it's only maybe 1 hour a week to start, they get the feel of it, they get the exposure, and that's one of the ways to do it also.
That's right. That is another platform element, definitely.
Yeah, and it's all there, and the exposure, I think, is very critical. Now, when you're dealing with this, all of a sudden, you've got the book, and you're ready to get out, and then you start to do it. Some of the publishing houses that you go to, is it? And I want to jump into just another area for a moment. When you're going to get your book published, there's a lot of self-publishing going on today. Is there value in the self-publishing as opposed to going to an existing publisher with a track record?
Are you talking about in terms of a platform, or just the difference between going traditional or self-published?
Getting your book there to go to a platform.
Well, you have to have a platform either way. So people think that, you know, when I talk about platform, you only need a platform if you want a traditional publisher. And it is true that a traditional publisher is looking for an aspiring author who has a platform. And the reason for that is because they want a business partner. They want to know you're going to sell books, and or that you can sell books and that you're willing to promote your book. They want a business partner. So the fact that you have a platform and you've built it and that you're showing that you're willing to do promotion, which is basically building a platform is all about doing promotion for yourself and for your book, that's enticing to them because they want a good business partner. Now, for the self-published author, you have to be a good business partner for yourself. You have to be a good business person. And so you have to build platform as well. So platform is just as important there, if not more important, because you are the only person doing promotion. Now, a traditional publisher isn't going to do a ton of promotion for you anyway. In this day and age, they really don't do a lot to help, but they do a little. And so if you're self-published, it's totally up to you, and therefore platform's all the more important, and you need to build it before your book ever comes out. You can build it afterwards, but, you know, it's all the better if you've built platform beforehand, and then when you say, here's my book, my self-published book, or my traditionally published book, but let's say self-published, when you say, here it is, everyone runs out and buys it.
Okay, but let's take this another step. You said the magic word early on. You said the word they want a business partner, somebody to do business with, because their job obviously is to sell books and create some kind of an income, some kind of a bottom line for it. There's many people who decide to be an author. They do not realize that once you move into that realm, that the word business has got to be there. And there are too many people out there that they understand that there's a word called entrepreneur, but they don't quite know what the definition is, and they get into problems because they don't know how to do business.
Well, that's right. And most writers are not considering their book as a business at all. And they're not approaching this whole project as a business project. They are not looking at, when they approach a publisher or an agent, for that matter, they're not looking at this as anyone wanting a business partner. When I wanted to approach an agent, you know, people would say to me, why do you want an agent? You're going to have to give them a percentage of everything you earn, and the same with a traditional publisher. You're not going to earn as much money. The way I looked at it was, these are my business partners. My agent becomes my business partner. She helps me get that deal. She helps me negotiate it. She helps me make sure that I'm getting the rights I need to get, all of that. And my publisher is now my business partner also. They have a vested interest in my book, and they're putting money behind my book. So, yes, I lose something, but I gain something as well. And from their perspective, it's the same. They're gaining a business partner, someone who's going to provide them with a product and help them sell it. And it's all a business. And if you self-publish, it's the same. You are creating a published product. It's a book, and you're going to, it becomes a source of income for you, and you have to look at it in the big picture. You know, what else can you do around that book that can help sell it? And people forget about that, and that's part of doing a book proposal, which we've talked about before. There are parts of a book proposal where you think about spin-offs, and I tell people to look at that spin-off section, which is usually just, you know, what other books are you going to write that relate to it, to look at it beyond that as, you know, could you do coaching? Could you do teleseminars? Could you become a professional speaker? You know, what other things could you do around that book that become a business? The book becomes your business center.
Now, by the way, Nina, we're starting to run out of time, but there's a word that I think most authors, if they're going to get into business, if they realize that it is a business that they're getting into, it's the word called sell. They're frightened to death of it. I can't tell you how many people I've said, okay, so what are you doing with your book? Well, you're selling it. Well, no, I don't sell anything. Well, then that means that you're going to create the book, you'll put the money on for it, and you're going to give it away. Well, maybe not. It's a whole course. Nina, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
The easiest place to find me is ninaamir.com, N-I-N-A-A-M-I-R.com, or you can look me up at Copyright Communications, C-O-P-Y-W-R-I-G-H-T ptcommunications.com.
And we'll see you next week.
No, not next week. I'll be in New York the week after that.
We'll see you the week after that. We're going to sit here. And
all right. Take care, okay, Michael Ray.
Good night.
You're going to miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're going to miss my hugging. You're going to miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, your way had your way. And if you now, some of these days,
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Richard London with us. He's the author of Doctorate of Business Life, Creating Success and Wealth with No Limits. It's a forthcoming book. It's on its way. He's a world-renowned author, and he's a business consultant. Tells us what our future really looks like, and he says there's so much uncertainty in the world today, and people know that the tools of the past are no longer working for them, and you couldn't have said it any better. Hi, welcome to the show, Richard.
Oh, Michael, my pleasure.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure to be here and to share this great wisdom with your listeners worldwide.
Now, by the way, I think that sentence in and of itself, people know that the tools of the past are no longer working for them today. I think Einstein had something like that going in front, but he was right, and you're absolutely right. What used to work doesn't work anymore, and I think the biggest problem is we're hanging on to the old ways, good, bad, or indifferent, and we're dealing in a world now that the rules have changed, and the players on the field are different also.
I agree. And one of the factors that is very, very important in this change is that humans really did not have a life path. They set their goals. I want to be a millionaire. I want to be a billionaire now. But it's not a life path. And part of the rule change was you needed a life path. And so my parents, your parents, grandparents, they had no life path. They chose a career basically fatalistically. Sure. Now in the 21st century, it's called Becoming a Wellness Heir. And in Becoming a Wellness Heir, it's an actual life path. And it's a directional force of systems, wisdoms, that enables humans to create wealth, wellness, love, peace, and spirituality in abundance and balance. The key word is balance. The reason the rules don't work in the 21st century is, guess what? Humans have no balance.
Homeostasis, gone. You got it.
Yes. Yes.
No, loud and clear. And I think
fear destroys that balance, too. Yes.
Yeah, we get torn from all different directions. You get torn culturally, politically, economically, you know, and now let's add something else to the mix. The judgments that we have in our society today are not just within the framework of the continental United States. It's all over the world. So we are dealing with something that no one else has ever dealt with in the history of the planet, quote unquote. We are multinational now, and we're dealing with global strategies and global communities.
Yes, another key to change is living in authenticity. My grandparents, they came from Europe. They came here with the passion, with the desire, the love of a new country, and of building something from their heart and from their soul. So one of the new rules is you have to live in authenticity, and we have a world that is not very authentic.
Okay, but let's define authenticity. Because let me give you a quick definition for me, and then we can work it together. To be authentic, I have to really give outside. I have to be expressing what I feel inside, and I think that's one of the problems that we have today. We have a lot of people expressing, but that's not really what they're about internally.
Okay. Well, the 21st century, in Dr. London's definition, is authenticity is wholeness in mind, body, and spirit. And this should have actually been the definition of authenticity throughout its creation, but it has not been. So when you're whole in your mind, and you're whole in your body, and you're whole in your spirit, then you're truly authentic. Yes.
Okay, so everything, well, maybe we're saying the same thing in a different way.
Yes, we are saying the same thing in a different way. You're absolutely correct.
If we are in sync, inside and outside, and outside it can also mean spiritually, etc., there's where the authenticity is. If we're, quote-unquote, you said it, if we're in balance.
Yeah, and authenticity is about choice and freedom. When you're truly in authenticity, your choices are very clear, and you have absolute freedom. Like, I travel on a global basis, and I get to say anything I want to anyone. Absolutely. I never hold back any thought to anyone. Yeah, as I travel in the world. Yes. That's part of being truly authentic. Yes. Is being able to express yourself and feeling that the choices you make are the choices that are correct, and seeing yourself as having absolute freedom. Yes.
Most of the problems that we have today as a culture, as a society, the culture within the society, is that we're very confused as to who we are, and more important, why we are. And that in and of itself is the platform, Richard. That's the base of any authenticity, of any wealth, any life path, is you got to have that grounding, that foundation of who you are to fall back on. So when you do fall down, and you will fall down, you can get back up again with the strength that will move you forward, that will propel you.
Yes. And see, we have a world where humans blocks their fears and unhealthy agreements and veils have created who they are today. And a typical agreement would be their relationship with money. Most human beings have a poor relationship with money. They heard their parents say money does not grow on trees, that it's difficult, the rich are unhappy. These are all false use of words. It feels great to be wealthy. It feels great to have a sense of wellness in your life. All those things are great. So it's this relationship that humans have with money in the world today. And because they're not aware of what their blocks, fears, and unhealthy agreements are, they don't have the ability to rewrite it. So you can actually rewrite your agreements.
Oh, okay, by the way, when you're talking about rewriting agreements, we're also talking about everything that you've talked about so far is learned. Everything we do is learned. It's a learned behavior. We've learned to think this way. We've learned to act this way. And the key here is this, and you said it, and I'll say it in a different word. Something like that. Thanks, I got the word. If you've learned something, you can also unlearn and relearn, and it's as simple as just the shift in the way you think about things. Once that occurs, the entire world is the same, except everything that turns out in your world is completely different. It's balanced, it's authentic, it's the way that you want it.
Yes, I agree. But actually, you can rewrite your entire life. Many humans are living in their past, abuse as children, abuse as young adults in some manner. So you can actually rewrite it. Once it's rewritten, it's your life and it's real. And then you leave the past. Yes, I spend all my time, every single minute of my time in the now and creating in the future. And See, the definitions that were created for the words that humans use in many cases were incorrect. So you have the ability as a human being to create words that have greater meaning. Like I created a word called wellness air. And it's abundance and balance in wellness, wealth, love, peace, and spirituality. That's the actual definition. I created the word prodigy mind, where the internet and the mind are one. So you, me, and every human being that walks on the earth, our life is about what we think consciously and subconsciously, and also the words that go in and out of our mouth and the food that goes in and out of our mouth. That's who we are. And you have the ability to control all of that. Yes.
You know, by the way, the words and the foods, there's a cause and effect. There's a reversible cause and effect with that. You eat certain foods, it's going to turn to chemical. All foods turn to chemical. And it could be a chemical that can cause a disconnect within your brain chemistry, within your body chemistry. And you're absolutely right. It's a combination of all of these things that cause us to think the way we think and not necessarily be who we are, because we are always who we are. We just mask it, and too many people are afraid to open up that gate and allow yourself to come out.
Oh, yes. I have some, I'm going to be coming out with flashcards. These are all great thoughts. And wealth really is one clear thought away. Wealth is one clear thought away. Creation is very easy, but it's the clarity of thought. And I redefine clarity. Clarity defined is the use of great wisdom to create wealth, wellness, and eliminate fear. Yes.
You know,
humans live in a state of fear because they lack clarity. If you have clarity, you're not fearful of anything.
Yes. Okay, but let's define fear. What is fear?
You know, there's a definition that many people view false emotions appearing real. And in actuality, that's what fear is all about. Fear is false emotions. And I'll give you an example. When I was a little boy, and maybe your parents as well, my parents were giving me this boogeyman business. The boogeyman was going to get me not to go out at nighttime. So when I was 4 years old, I actually left the home at nighttime, went looking for the boogeyman so I could scare the boogeyman. Because I didn't want to accept that belief system. So basically, fear is the acceptance of other people's unhealthy belief systems. Yeah.
Or what you've taken on and you believe that you can't control. I truly believe.
You believe it to be true, yes.
If you can control it, if you can control it, you're not afraid of it. And I think that's really where fear is. I think the definition came up for me a couple of days ago on the show, and I hadn't even thought about it since like 1982. But, you know, fear is the fear of when you think somebody can hit back harder, when somebody has more power over you, when something has more power over you and you're totally out of control and you can't do anything about it. That is really what fear is about, that inability to accept yourself as you are and know that you can deal with anything that comes up. And it doesn't mean you're always going to win. Well, I take that back. You always will. It may not look like winning at the time, but you may not be able to get what you want out of it at the moment, but it'll come if you just let it happen.
I agree. But when I was a little boy, I never listened to my teachers. I never listened to my parents. My thought process was this inner strength that I have. So I've never experienced fear. I've never experienced envy, jealousy, the normal things that humans fear. So I'm called a warrior, and I think of myself as a warrior in business, a warrior in my personal life. So you don't have to have any fears whatsoever in your life. And really, clarity and, see, wisdom works for everyone every time. Remember that. Wisdom works for everyone every time. Most information passed from one human being to another is a human's perception of what is true. I try to share with my clients and with listeners on a global basis wisdom, because it does work every time for everyone. And yeah, I've used wisdom my entire life, and it has always worked.
Wisdom,
like, as an example,
yeah.
I speak around the world, and many people say to me, what book can I buy? What book can I buy? And I always say the greatest book is human wisdom and experience. So if you have someone in your life who is a person who possesses wisdom and great experience, there's a great book to tap into. And in the 21st century, humans need to do that. And what are the, you know, in the world that we live in, success in business depends about on this great balance and this great wholeness. You have to be at least 80% whole in mind, body, and spirit to be able to create great wealth and great wellness in your life. And I use those words together because we're really talking in the world today about financial wellness. Yes.
So no, absolutely. Richard, let me hold you up because we're starting to run out of time. But two things. One is, and I think you're absolutely spot on when it comes to wisdom, but if you want to define wisdom is going to be what you do with the information that you've gathered. You can go to school, and academically it's the most wonderful thing in the world, but you're not going to learn the world until you get out and you try to apply it, and you fall down, and you get up, and you fall down, and you get up, and you begin to realize that it's the wisdom that academically you're not going to learn. It's getting out into the world and experiencing yourself with it. That said, can we get your website? And it's been really good having you on.
Sure. It's doctorateoflife.com, doctorate oflife.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Take care.
Have
good
a
night.
Great evening.
You too.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, oh, that's all, oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, oh, that's all, oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Taylor Shire with us. She's the author of Soul Reunion, The Return Home from Separation. She is a dynamic and she's a gifted author. She's a teacher. She's an intuitive counselor who's committed to inspiring the people of this world to access and live from the magnificence, their soul gifts, their strengths, and their purposes. She offers powerful tools that bridge the soulful and the heart-centered self to the vibrant, joyful expression of life. And her mission is to see each individual's soul destiny known and fulfilled. Susan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. Now, by the way, when we talk about a soul, there are so many people who define a soul in a different way, and there's so many people who know it's there somewhere, but they don't quite know what it is. How do I recognize it when I've touched my soul?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. You recognize it because something inside yourself, I usually consider it in the space of the heart, lights up. It's a kinesthetic experience. When you know you've tapped into your soul, you feel more alive, actually. And it's the way to know you're connected.
So
in
sometimes
an embodied way.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes I remember when it was about 2 years ago, summertime, I walked around in the front of the house and I was going towards the garage, and just for that second, there was the really pretty flowers sitting there, and I never really noticed them before. But I stood there just for a second and I just let that whole moment happen, and they were absolutely gorgeous. And for that moment, the flower was alive, I was alive, and there was something, there was a third something there that caused the dimension of that experience to be more than what happened for the rest of the day.
Yes, I totally agree in that. What I say is that the soul is connected to everything, everywhere. So if we get connected to our soul, we're getting connected to the secret of manifestation, which is all those dimensions and qualities of experience that we wish to have.
Okay, so when we fall down, I know that we talk about, you know, the separation from spirit, etc., but when we fall down, isn't that our spirit saying, fall down, because you're not recognizing what the true gifts of life are and what you're really supposed to be about, and if you fall down, you'll stop the path you're on and maybe take a second look at your life. Dilution? Must have been a good question. Somehow, we dropped her.
Agree with is that you're falling down.
Okay.
Hello?
We lost you for a minute. Go ahead and start from the beginning. We lost you just for a second.
I'd be glad to. Okay. You fall down, it really is life saying there's a part of you that is not engaged in life that needs to get reconnected, reunited with life, and it wants your attention.
There is
so
a story.
Yes, it's a, mm-hmm.
Go ahead. All right, but there was a story that I told last week, and I want to, and just apropos to do it again for anybody who wasn't listening when this happened. Everything in life,
right?
every time you get knocked down, it happens to be a total gift. I talked to somebody about 5-6 months ago who, when she was in when she was in college, she was a really great athlete, and she wanted to go on to be a professional, and her coach told her that she wasn't worth it, she couldn't do it, she wasn't good enough, and he wasn't interested in coaching her. So instead of her falling apart and quitting, she had a couple of wonderful words to say to him, and she went out and she decided that she was going to do it no matter what. So she found another coach, and this coach was happened to be really good, and they worked together, and he developed her, and she went on, she became a professional. Now, not only did she become a professional, she's teaching now in a university athletics. But here's the key to the story. The gift in the story, she married the second coach.
And all women love the happy ending for sure.
and when you come right down to it, had she not been knocked down, she'd have never met her husband.
I agree, but it's not so much that she got knocked down, it's how she handled it so well.
Yes.
Like you said, she handled it really well. When she got knocked down, she didn't really get completely knocked down like one of those bozo bag clown things. She actually went, oh, okay, so this person doesn't want me. I'm going to go where I am wanted.
Yeah, yeah. And my comment
that's the difference.
Sure. Mm-hmm. My comment when I heard the story, I said, we need to send flowers to the first coach and say thank you.
Yes, yes. I agree.
Okay.
So she could get in touch with what doesn't work. Uh-huh.
When did you find your soul? When did you know, when did you finally recognize that real essence of your soul to get you on this path that you're on?
Yeah. Well, you know, I find that it's been an emergence. The soul emerges through us as we go through life. when I was, it wasn't one of those lightning experience, you know, lightning bolt experiences, near-death experience. All of a sudden, I started realizing, this is what matters to me. I was out of college, and I said, I really want to discover who I really am, because who I was growing up didn't work for me. I was numb and dumb, and it didn't work for me. So I started the road of discovery. And in one of the books I wrote a chapter on my soul's journey. And I think it's such a great exercise for people to go back in their life and discover where their soul started opening up, you know, from day zero and little increments along the way, teenager, you name it, to times when they made soul choices and they had that sense of essence of something coming forward, or that moment like you were so beautifully describing, of feeling a connection to that something beyond the immediate. And it, I find it just keeps emerging and emerging, which makes it very much more fun than just saying, I want to get connected, and it's a flat experience. A one-time shot.
Now, obviously, each one of us has a soul. But what creates that disconnect? Why is it that so many people are disconnected and they're not in touch with the soul?
Yes. It's because at certain points in their life they make choices, and I believe way past other past lives, we have a soul incarnation. We were alive as a soul before we started doing earth incarnations. And there are soul wounds and there are wounds of choices where we said yes to something that made us feel safe or small or protected, etc. And those are the choices when we say no to the soul and yes to fear.
Okay, now when we talk about fear, it may not be fear that you're feeling at the moment, but it's that fear of you're going to lose something if you move with the way your soul is directing you. So you're going to take this easy route and that's right. Yeah.
That's right. You don't take the high road. You don't choose your soul's perspective. You choose wanting to belong, wanting not to be abandoned, all of those, which really are fears, actually. Mm-hmm.
And most people don't love themselves. And I think there's a problem. If you and I met, and if I don't love me, how can I love you?
Right. And that love for me, I believe, comes from not just loving little me, but being in touch with that larger spiritual quality of love that we imbue ourselves with. And when we're imbued with it, when we embody it, when we feel it inside, then we radiate it versus trying to love a part of ourselves. Little me, I'm going to love her, I'm going to love her, I'm going to love her.
Yeah, but we're taught not to love yourself. Remember, you can't be selfish, you got to do it for everybody else. That doesn't work. If you do it for everybody else and you leave nothing for you, what is it that you have to offer it?
That's right. Your cup is definitely empty.
It's not really a good place to come from. And I really believe getting beyond the, you know, love yourself and joy and rapture and all the words that go along with it, you can't give to anybody what you don't have yourself. I can't teach you anything I don't know, or vice versa. I can't love you if I don't love me. If I don't experience something, how am I supposed to share it with you?
That's right. I agree wholeheartedly. And in this book, I write about this book called Soul Reunion. I have a number of books, but this is the one we're speaking about. I write about the fact that there's a home base that we want to know within us. And that's a deep part of knowing love, feeling that you have a place called home base within you to come from, to spring from. It's always there. It's like a little campfire always burning within us that ignites that flame of love.
Yeah, and then, by the way, one of the things that most of us are frightened to death of is we don't think we have free will. And you were born with something called free will. You get this hand of cards you dealt, and you get to play them any way you want. You want pain? Yes. You want happiness? Yes. You want this? You want that? You're going to get everything that you absolutely want. I did an interview some months back, and it had to do with there was a man talking about that, well, you know, if we have free will, why does God do this and why does God do that and whatever? I listened to
right.
And at the end of the conversation, I said, but that's an example of free will. There are people who kill people. There are people who torture people. There are people who do all of that. You have free will. Don't do it. And it won't happen.
Well put, absolutely. We were given choice to choose out of light, out of spirit, out of our soul perspective, what do we want to create? But we have misused that choice. We have misused that will. And yes, the beauty of will is we can choose not to kill. We can choose not to destroy.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's too simple.
We can choose to embody spirit. Bottom line, that was supposed to be, at one level, the only choice we have. It was just the myriad of ways that are before us for how to do that.
Okay, here comes the
big... This world is pretty phenomenal.
Oh, absolutely. Here comes the big question. I get soul reunion. I have no idea how to love myself. Are you going to take me by the hand and give me the steps to show me how to do it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is definitely a how-to book. How to get reunited with your soul in all aspects of your life. I talk all the way through it of all the different patterns that we work with. Fear, self-sabotage, feeling helpless, which is a big one in this recession. All those places that we find ourselves landing in and how to come out of that and get back into being connected with the soul in that situation, in that challenge.
I think resistance is one of the worst words that were ever created in this world that we have. And I think a great example of that is your body surfing down a river, and there's a big stone in front of you. And if you resist the current, if you resist it, you're going to insert yourself into the stone. But if you just relax and quote-unquote go with the flow, you're going to go around the stone. And I think that's the problem. We resist too much, and if you just stop resisting, you'll get what you want.
Yes, it's been said in many cultures in many different ways that stress is not being willing to be where you are and feeling as though you're supposed to be someplace else. You want to do something else. You want to move that rock instead of going around it, like you said.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be stressful. Stress is all self-created.
And we are so worried about what somebody's going to think about us. That's a problem.
Yes.
And by the time, I agree. I drive everybody I know nuts. You call me, if you call me a, I'll say it nicely, if you call me a butthead, my response to that is, you bet, and I'm really good at it. What are you going to do with that?
That's right. You're going to play with it. It's called holding it in a lighthearted way makes you very buoyant and very flexible. And people get mad because it's pushing their buttons because they don't feel so buoyant and flexible and lighthearted as you are about everything.
And they're not.
And that's the gift of life.
Yes, and they're not.
That you're showing them.
Yeah, and they're not able to affect you. So there's the problem there. That's the key.
Yes.
Yes, we spend so much time.
Yeah, that's where they go into erg. I wanted to have an impact on him and show him who's boss.
And then the chairs, they start throwing those at me. But other than that, we're fine. But when you really come down to it, I believe, and stop me if I'm wrong. I'm not a clinician and I'm not a spiritualist. But at the same time, I really believe that if you stop trying to live everybody else's life. You stop trying to be what everybody else thinks you should be. That's when you take your first step on the path of having a good, soulful life. You get to be who you are.
Yes, and I believe that often we try to live other people's lives, whether it's through television or other people around us personally or our families, because we want to be part of something. We inherently know at a soul level that we are meant to be a part of something very large and very grand, and we grasp as humans to these smaller pieces to try to be part of that, and we miss the boat, and then we don't get to be our authentic self. When we are authentic selves, as you were mentioning, then we feel like we belong to that other dimension, that larger piece, that sense of oneness that's there already present, and then life lights up for us.
Absolutely. We're just about out of time now. Do you have a website, Susan, that we can find you at?
I do. It is called soulmastery.net. soulmastery.net.
Wonderful. Hey, Susan, thank you.
And that's where you'll find me working with the soul all the time.
I love it. Okay, thank you so much for being here. Good night.
Great. Good night, Michael.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah. Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sarah Wendell with us. She is the author of Everything I Knew About Love I Learned from Romance Novels. She's more commonly known as Smart Bitch Sarah. She's the co-founder and the current mastermind of popular romance review, The Smart Bitch's Trashy Books, and co-author of Beyond Heaving Bosoms. The smart little, I got, Sarah, I love every second of it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. First, thank you for that music. That was delightful. And yes, I really like long titles.
Oh, no, it was great. It was great. No, okay, what created the romance novels? Because I would venture to guess that so many people are affected by romance novels, and they listen to it, they see it, they think it's real, and that's how they fall in love.
Well, romance novels are actually a very old style of storytelling. Romance novels, as you would identify them in the drugstore and the bookstore, became popular in the late 70s and early 80s, but they're basically narratives of courtship. And courtship has been part of narrative storytelling since we all sat around a fire and decided to talk to each other instead of staring at the fire. Romance novels are all about people falling in love and having a happy ever after. And there's a number of women who read and write them, and it's an amazing community online.
Okay, now when you deal with this community online, and I thought it was interesting, some years back, I was listening to a couple of women talking, it could have been a couple of men, but it was a couple of women talking about what they saw in the soaps, and they were so tied to the characters in the soaps, it was almost as if it was real. They couldn't wait for tomorrow to see what Jessica did, or how Bob handled this, and what the dad was going to do, and if he was going to have the heart attack. And I would really believe if it's about that, if the romance novels are truly about that courtship and connection in that way, that people live them vicariously because they're not getting that in their real life.
Oh, I would disagree with you on that one. There's a big difference between romance novels and soap operas. For one thing, the minute two people find maybe 5 seconds of happiness in a soap opera, the writers are going to find a way to have something dastardly happen to them. So soap operas are more stories of fracture and repair and fracture and repair. And romance novels are stories of courtship and obstacles and then overcoming those obstacles and happy endings. But by and large, women who read romance novels are mistakenly believed to be living vicariously through their books. And many believe that they are undersexed, frustrated, miserable, lonely women, most likely wearing fanny packs or sweatshirts with kittens on them. They have too many cats. They live alone, and this is their source of joy. And that's actually completely not true. The Romance Writers of America have done many studies and revealed that most women who read romance novels are highly educated, and most of us are in happy relationships ourselves. I myself met my husband in high school, and we've been married for over 11 years.
Wow.
What I found interesting while writing this book was the number of women who read romances who told me, I'm always the person who my friends come to for advice because I know what to do. So instead of living vicariously, we're actually learning valuable lessons about how to overcome conflict.
Okay, well, let's touch on this then, because I'm looking at your press release, and a lot of this is making a lot of sense. You know, how to identify what's acceptable and not acceptable in a partner. How does the romance novel illustrate that?
Well, there's a wonderful author named Robin Carr who writes a series of books set in the California Redwoods, and she was one of my favorite interviews for this book, and I almost got so angry at her because she wrote the whole book for me in about 4 paragraphs. But one of the things that she said that I was so blown away by was the fact that romance novels teach you what not to accept. When a woman sees models of what she should never accept in a relationship, the reader understands that heroine deserves happiness. And so when you see characters who leave abusive relationships or refuse to tolerate people who abuse them or no longer tolerate people who take advantage of them, that's a role model. And we identify with those heroines and cheer them on.
Okay, now, and I think this is critical also. The never-ending courtship keeps the love alive. You know, and in today's world, if we would have more and more of that, we wouldn't have the 60% divorce rate that we're seeing.
I completely agree. I've been doing a lot of interviews to talk about this book, and one question I get is, well, don't romance readers think that their men should be like romance heroes and they should all gallop in on a white horse like Fabio with lots of hair and maybe a mullet and a big puffy shirt and a giant, giant belt? And I always have to say, no, that's sort of ridiculous. I've known my husband since high school, and he had a mullet then, but he doesn't now. And when he does things like unload the dishwasher or make my coffee and leave it on the counter for me, that's a romance hero moment because that communicates that he's thinking of me and he wants me to know that he cares that I'm happy and that I've, you know, got my coffee, which, you know, who wouldn't be happy having coffee?
No,
Teresa Medeiros is another author, says in the book that you should never stop courting your spouse because courtship is all about communicating to someone that you have feelings for them. That never gets old. Learning that you are loved and that someone cares about you, that's always worth communicating.
Okay, now, this one has got to be a good one. To be the heroine in your own life. That's got to be kind of interesting because what do you do? How do you, you know, and I hear heroine, hero, I'm thinking of Superman or Superwoman. You throw off the clothes, you got the costume on, and you're out there saving the world.
Well, the truth is there's a lot of different kinds of romance novels, and some of them do feature super-powered, magnificent, great women who are just incredible characters, and some of them feature women in the past and women in the present who are just like me, more or less. Being the heroine of your life means that you don't sit around and wait for someone to gallop in on a horse and solve all your problems for you, and you don't sit and expect that someone else will take care of you. Being the heroine of your life means that you identify what you want, and you decide what it is that you want to have, not what someone else thinks you should have, but what you wish and what you want. One of the most powerful responses I've had when I was researching this book and since it came out were the women who said, you're right, I did not want to settle. I knew that there wasn't, this person who I was with was not the one for me, and I knew that there would be somebody who would make me feel the way I wanted to feel, and I found that person because I wasn't willing to settle, and I knew what I wanted. That's what being the heroine of your life is.
Now, by the way, when it really comes down to it, if what I'm hearing you say now, what I'm hearing you say, if I was a woman and if I was confused about the world, the relationship world, the romantic world out there, if I picked up the romance novels, there might be a way that I would see this step-by-step path to getting what I wanted out of a romance, to see what it was actually about and maybe what to stay away from.
I would think that with a steady diet of romances, because I read a lot of them, I think if you read a good number of them, you'll begin to identify who are the people that I, characters that I like, who are the characters that I gravitate towards, and who are the characters that I really dislike and why. And in those reactions, you learn about yourself. And so if you read a lot of them and you're reading about courtship and you read about different kinds of men and different kinds of women and you identify what you like about those characters, then you learn about yourself. And in that construct, you'd be able to learn more about how to have happy relationships because you've watched so many good and bad ones play out in the course of the narrative.
You know, the words happily ever after seem not to resonate with most people today. But the words, and this is right out of your press release, and I think it's important, what happily ever after really means and how to achieve it in your own life now.
Yes. One of the reasons why romance is so very popular right now, and sales have been getting better for most of the romance wings of publishing houses, while other parts of publishing have had difficult times, is that when your life is scary and uncertain, and in the current economy, there are a lot of people whose lives are scary and uncertain. Picking up a book where you know it's all going to be okay, no matter how bad it gets, it's going to be okay in the end, is wonderfully uplifting and reassuring. But when you read about all the happily ever afters in these novels, one thing that I think romance readers, and certainly myself, I can definitely take this lesson, is that happy ever after starts right now, because you have to identify what it is that's going to make you happy. And then you have to make sure that you're achieving those things each day. Happy ever after takes work. It's not easy. You can't just develop it out of thin air. A book that arrives at a happy ending that isn't satisfying is not a good reading experience, but a happy ending that comes with work and effort on the part of the characters is a wonderful experience. The same is true in real life. Whatever it is that you're wanting that will make you happy, it takes work, but you can get there.
Okay, so let's say you and I met, hypothetically, we get into a relationship, and then we decide, on the practical end of this now, so that we decide that we want to do happily ever after. So we sit down and we start drafting what happily ever after means. And then once we both have a common definition, we start to apply that daily, and that creates the happily ever after, because each day is a happily ever after.
I would think that that's true, and I think that in couples that have a good level of communication, that can be done. I know what makes my husband really angry, and he knows what makes me really angry. And conversely, we know what makes each other happy and what makes each other feel cared for and looked after. And the same is true of my friends. I see something, and I know my friend will enjoy it. I'll make sure to find it for her and give it to her. It's all about knowing people and being able to make sure that their happiness is as important as your own.
But what about sitting down and structuring it? You know, we say that we know somebody, we love somebody. But most of us don't know that. You know, you take it for granted, you in the general sense of the word. You take it for granted as a guy. You know, you know what a woman's like, you know what she wants, and you know how you love her. And 9 out of 10 times, that's not the way unless you ask. So what I was thinking about as you were talking was, if you sat down and you structured a, you know, this is what makes me happy. This is how I receive love. This is how I like to be kissed. And wouldn't it be interesting if you could have a quote-unquote almost a workbook before you got into a relationship, look at the mistakes that wouldn't be made and the craziness that wouldn't go on because somebody was misunderstood?
Yes, if people came with an owner's manual that was in well-written English, we would all have a much easier time putting ourselves together and having good, solid relationships.
Sarah, that's
no
your next...
hex wrench required.
Wait, did you hear that? That's your next book?
No hex wrench required. I don't know if that title is long enough. I might need a longer title, but I'll come up with something.
Okay. And within it, it's a workbook of how to do it. But I really believe that that's, you know, if you really look through everything, you know, I know about love, I learned from romance novels, wouldn't it be interesting to create a workbook coming right from that. Do you know how many people would appreciate that?
That would be a fascinating project. Thank you for that idea. I think that is a really interesting idea.
Yeah, because most people need to be held by the hand to say, this is what happens if you do that, because they haven't experienced it before. Just a thought.
I have learned, after a lot of time on the internet, never to presume to know why someone has said something. But I also apply that in real life. I never presume to know why someone has said or done something, because 9 times out of 10, my guess is wrong. But you're right. Many people jump to conclusions that create more tension because they're not correctly reading what the other person has said or done.
Prime example, and it's right there, and it hits the spot. You say to your husband, you know, did you take out the garbage? Is it a question or an accusation? You hear it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. You're exactly right about that.
Yeah. Okay. That's.
But if you say, I'm on my way out the door. Did you grab the garbage, or do you want me to take it?
That's a different story.
Not a judgment.
That's being intentional. Because you know what the result's going to be. It's going to be a comfortable, happy result. You know, you say the great example is of the couple that sat down for dinner one night, and she made spaghetti, and it was his absolute favorite dish, and he loved spaghetti. And he took a bite, and he looked at her, and he said, boy, dinner's great tonight. Well, within seconds, he's wearing the spaghetti. The fight's on for the night. It's all over the drapes. What she heard was what was wrong with every other night. What, they finally got it right? So we'd never know how the other people's going to take it. Battle. Okay. So when you write the manual, I want to be the first one who interviews you.
Yes, sir. No question.
Okay, it's good. Okay, let me ask you this. We got about a minute and a half to go. Is there something I should have asked you that I didn't that would have brought more information up? I think this is really... I looked at it at first and I went, oh, God, what am I getting into? And you know what? As we got into this, this is really good.
I really appreciate that. The nice thing about the book is that I'm the type of reader who flips to the end to see what happens, because that's just what I do. And I know it's not good, but I do it anyway. And when I wrote this book, I included a final summary chapter. So if you find the book, you can look at the end, and I give a nice summary of everything in the book. And if that's interesting to you, then read the rest of it, because I had a lot of fun. And there's wonderful romance authors and romance readers who share incredible stories about why these books are so important to them. But the two most important points of the book is that romance as a concept is how we treat each other and how we treat ourselves. You should never put someone else's happiness above your own, but conversely, you can't necessarily treat your happiness as more important than the person who you're with. So you treat yourself and the people that you care about with compassion and kindness and respect and understanding, and you end up with a never-ending happy ever after, which is a very fine goal.
And I got that one loud and clear. Sarah, hey, thank you so much for joining us. Your website, please, before we go, where we can find the books at.
You can find me at trashybooks.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for that music. I'm in the best mood now.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.